Today is Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder Awareness Day. This month also marks a long-awaited admission by the Canadian government that they haven't been doing enough to help a particular group of traumatized victims. Most of us are aware of how PTSD affects people who have directly experienced trauma. They're the soldiers, the victims of violent crimes, and first responders who run towards terrifying events instead of away from them.
I feel very afraid.
And I couldn't get rid of that feeling inside my chest. So
pretty much alienated myself from everyone.
But there is a different kind of sufferer that we often don't consider. And this is a story about a man who performed an ordinary civic duty, the kind that you or I might be asked to do tomorrow, and came away scarred. And he decided to do something about it. It's June 27th. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story.
This is a massive injustice to people who go through and perform their civic duty and are literally just, you are excused at the end of the day in court.
Mark Ferrant was just a citizen. He worked as a market researcher, and in 2014, he was summoned to jury duty. He quickly found himself selected and designated juror number 3 for a gruesome first-degree murder trial that included autopsy photos, graphic details of a fatal knife attack, and a defendant in the courtroom disfigured by a blaze he'd allegedly set to conceal his crime. After 4 months, that trial ended, but not Mark's. Tell me about the moment when you realized that the things you were seeing and hearing in court were having an effect on you.
Well, certainly when the autopsy photos and the coroner was detailing the attack, and you're basically watching on a monitor in front of you, shot after shot after shot of the victim laid out, going through detail of, you know, what a superficial stab wound is, what a puncture wound is, the wounds on her neck and the like, that, you know, that hits you pretty hard. It's one thing to see these things in, you know, in crime TV shows and in the media. It's another thing to see that this is somebody who's perished. That was very early on in the trial. And I just partitioned that and just focused on collecting the material in my mind and in my notes. But it's, you know, you park that away, but it stays with you. So I was seeing that stuff all the time, and I just sort of chalked it up. I thought, this is the stress of a juror. This is my responsibility. It's just going to go away.
When did you start to think that something might be wrong?
I didn't think that something was wrong while in court. I just, again, chalked it up to stress.
Right.
Certainly at the end of the trial and months afterwards was when I realized that, again, something was happening to me. And like a lot of people who go through trauma and the like, especially if you've never experienced it before, you're not familiar with those feelings. And so I just did my best to buckle down, you know, ignore it and get back to my life. And it just didn't happen.
How did your behavior change?
I started to, well, I really shut down socially. So I stopped calling people. I ignored emails that were of a social nature. Hey, let's go out for a beer. Hey, come over for a dinner party. I just ignored them altogether and just shut people out. At home, I was, pretty catatonic. I wasn't communicating with my spouse. I was not the father that I needed to be to my young daughter at the time. You know, at the end of the trial, a month later, my wife and I had our second child. It was a pretty traumatic time. You know, there's this joyous moment in your life where you've got this newborn child, and I just wasn't the same. I wasn't there for that, for my son, as I was for my daughter.
Were there any concrete things that you did, you know, behaviorally or anecdotally, that someone would see and say, something's going on with Mark?
Friends and family knew something was up. You know, I just was not, again, I was not the same person. I was not responsive. At home, it was getting worse and worse and worse. So I wasn't sleeping in my bed. If I was sleeping at all. So my sleep patterns just completely disappeared. I would go sometimes 3 days without sleeping, keeping a vigil for whatever reason in my house, lying at the foot of my daughter's bed, which she thought was great. but, you know, so I'm, you know, I assumed this role of guardian and just would not back down from it. But that's the thing, you know, mental illness is invisible for the most part. If you don't see the signs, and the signs aren't often there because people put up an enormous facade. So you're trying, and I was doing that too. I was trying my hardest not to let those feelings come up to the surface. So I would put a wall between me and whatever was in front of me. At the end of the day, that wall crumbled. I just finally broke down and said that I couldn't go on like this anymore and that there was something wrong with me. So family intervened. My spouse finally said, you know, you need to do something about this. We need to do something about this. You need to talk to somebody.
Did the words post-traumatic stress disorder ever enter your head before that?
No. No.
So what did you end up doing? Who diagnosed you?
There were check-ins with my family doctor, but that's really about it. And I was going through essentially interviewing psychologists and saying, you know, hey, I was a juror. Many of them said, I can't talk to you. You're a juror. It's illegal for us to have a conversation. And it took a while to find somebody. So it was frustrating. And it was tragic because I was getting sicker and sicker.
How did you turn it around?
Well, I turned it around by finally finding someone who was an expert in PTSD, going to the right clinician and working through it. And it took a long time. It took numerous sessions for me to really even unlock what was wrong with me, let alone begin a practice of treatment.
What kind of instruction do they give to jurors that go into these kind of murder trials? Did they give you any advice, any plans, anything to do?
That's a very good question because, and again, I'm an activist. I'm not a lawyer and I'm not a legal expert, but it really does vary and it depends on the judge. So some cases, at the beginning of the trial, the jury might receive very detailed instructions from the justice of their role, what's expected of them. There might even be a video showing their responsibility and the like. But it really varies from courthouse to courthouse and from justice to justice. So it's inconsistent. So we received some instructions, but really not a lot. So I had to sit there and ponder about what my role was. Who am I allowed to talk to? What is my responsibility here? And I just assumed silence, which was in fact correct, but wasn't instructed to that detail.
And what did you decide to do about all of this? The lack of resources, the trouble getting diagnosed, everything, your own battle with illness.
I didn't want this to happen to somebody else. And I had this feeling that it was. And I was angry. And I was, I thought this was a massive, this is a massive injustice to people who go through and perform their civic duty and are literally just, you are excused at the end of the day in court. And that was another thing that was frustrating at the time. I remember, you know, after being sequestered and deliberating and coming back in the courtroom and after all these months of observing this case, literally you're just thanked and you pick up your suitcase and you leave. So I was determined to do something about it. So I started to write letters to the Attorney General in Ontario and express my position that I think there should be services made available to jurors post-trial. And I started to write to the federal justice minister to express the same thing, that there should be services available to any juror across the country post-trial. Those letters went unanswered, and I wrote more, and they went unanswered. And I wrote more, and they went unanswered. Friends and I sat back and said, well, who can we talk to? Who is the individual out there who would understand and have a position on this? And the name we came up was Justice Patrick Lesage, who was the justice on the Paul Bernardo trial. And so I wrote about the most impassioned letter that I ever had in my life at that point to the former Chief Justice. And we sent it through correspondence through the federal body that oversees the justices in Canada. And he got back to me in 3 days. And so I was pretty stunned. I got an email from him saying that we should have a chat. So I sat in my car in the parking lot of my workplace and talked to him for 2 hours on the phone. And he said, you're absolutely right. There is a gap. And I'm sorry that I didn't do anything at the time either. I regret that when I provided counseling to the jurors in the Bernardo trial, which is what he did, that it didn't get extended to it being an open, accessible program. So that was the first time, that was the first case, the Bernardo case was the first time that counseling had been made available two jurors, specifically in Ontario. All 12 of them received it, and they were all grateful for it. So I had an ally at that point, and my next line of attack really was, at that point, coming forward. I knew that momentum on this issue wouldn't be achieved without talking publicly about it. I started to write all the attorney generals across the country at that point. Started to contact MPs, and I started to write with a lot of energy. Having an illness that keeps me up at night, I thought I'd make something of it. So I've got a lot of time on my hands because I'm not sleeping. I might as well write some letters.
So you go public in 2016, and now we're June 2018. Can you quickly tell me what we've achieved since you started writing those letters and going public?
In January of 2017, the Ontario government announced the Juror Support Program in Ontario. So that launched, and it was a toll-free counseling line or intervention line, really. So any juror can call that line, have access to a therapist for triage purposes, and then you're awarded up to 8 counseling sessions, 4 initially and then 4 more if required through the Attorney General's office. 11 other jurors wrote with me to the Justice Minister and the Prime Minister, and we called it the 12 Angry Letters campaign.
When was that?
That would have been, it was almost a year ago, so May 2017. And so I took those letters to Ottawa to deliver them to the Justice Minister and the Justice Ministry, as well as MPs and the Justice Committee, and what was then the Justice Committee. I hadn't contacted them directly, but I was working with some MPs who believed in this issue as well. Unfortunately, those letters weren't responded to by the Prime Minister or the Justice Minister. But however, the Justice Committee, which was the Justice and Human Rights Committee, unanimously agreed to study the issue of juror mental health. So it was a very successful trip to Ottawa, and they began hearings on it in November of 2017. It was a lengthy, exhaustive study that came out with some very concrete recommendations almost a year later.
So recommendations are before the provinces, and some provinces will and some provinces won't adopt them. What's concrete that we can point to right now that'll make a difference?
The Senate recently passed unanimously Bill C-211.
I proudly rise today to speak to my private member's bill, C-211, an act respecting a federal framework on post-traumatic stress disorder at third reading.
Initially for first responders, military, police, and the like, but it's really a bill that is to address the issue, some would say an epidemic of PTSD in our country. So that was wonderful news. It received royal assent last week, and it's very timely now that this is PTSD Awareness Month and PTSD Awareness Day. Hopefully what will come out of that will be a very measured response to how we deal with post-traumatic stress disorder, not just within the impact groups, but Canadians across the country who experience it, as I did. We're expecting probably one of the most difficult cases in recent memory to go to trial in potentially in September.
Alleged serial killer Bruce MacArthur is charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder.
They have found the remains of another person from those planters removed from this property, and they've laid an 8th first-degree murder charge against alleged killer Bruce MacArthur.
That's going to be a very challenging case for jurors. That's that involves a community in complete disarray and you know, devastated by what happened to them. I don't see that trial going quickly. So how well equipped are we right now in Ontario to support a jury? Are we compensating them appropriately right from the outset of the trial? What kind of instructions are we giving that jury? What kind of support are we giving them in terms of access to compensation for care, for elder care or child care? We'll have a new attorney general announced imminently in this province.
Right.
And I think that individual needs to take those recommendations and, again, show leadership. Ontario was the first province to announce a juror support program based on my discussions and my taking this issue live. I think Ontario can, again, step forward and show leadership.
How much faith do you have that all of Canada will give jurors the proper support?
There are provinces that are highly resistant to it for whatever reason. I've sent out numerous communications to provincial attorney generals. One in particular, I've not heard anything from. That's why we need to have our federal justice minister champion these recommendations. So she needs to really take leadership on this issue and be the advocate for all Canadians to take these recommendations, meet with their provincial counterparts, which was also one of the recommendations, meet with them as soon as possible, and talk about how we are going to evolve this.
How often do you still think about what you saw in the courtroom?
It haunts me. I get it every now and again. It's odd that the occasions where it will pop back in. You know, I'm not ashamed of it anymore. It's part of my life.
A lot of people give that advice to people struggling with all kinds of mental illness, is talk about it,
yep.
Get it out there. Is that what works?
It does. It does. And you know, again, I'm not ashamed of being labeled somebody who has a mental illness. In fact, I wear it now proudly. It's just part of my life. It's just something I have to do. It's something that is part of me. It's just like anybody else with an affliction or a disability. So it's just part of who I am now.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks for taking the time.
Thanks for having me.
That was The Big Story. You can find us on Apple, Google, and wherever you get your podcasts. You can reach us at Big Story Podcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and visit us at thebigstorypodcast.ca. Don't forget to subscribe and tell your friends. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.